I don't think enough people realize how much they have control over their own way of life. And I've always believed that we write our own stories. And if you don't like the way things are working out, write yourself a new ending.
Welcome to Jump Podcast. I'm your host, Traveling Jackie, and I'm here to explore travel, adventure, and lifestyle in ways meant to motivate you to move and experience the world outside your comfort zone and to do big, courageous things with your one life. Let this show be a source of advice and inspiration, and remember that in the end, it's you who takes the leap. This episode is supported by Osprey, my go-to luggage brand for everything since 2015, and by Eco Chile, a one-stop shop for planning custom trips to Chile and Argentina. So stay tuned for more from them. And of course, we're supported by Jump Adventures and our own collection of epic adventure itineraries to Patagonia and beyond. Let us send you on your dream adventure. You can find out more and browse trips at jumpadventures.com. Hello, my friends, and welcome back to the show. I think you may know this about me, but I am and have been for many years an Osprey ambassador. And today I am joined by a fellow Osprey ambassador. His name is James Mills. And before I introduce him, I just want to mention that those of us on the ambassador team at Osprey, through our own platforms and leadership and whatever it is that we all uniquely do, part of what brings us together as a team is that we are all also aligned with what Osprey calls their philanthropic pillars of access, conservation, and community, which essentially are three of the reasons that we love and support Osprey as a brand. And if you're curious to learn more about what those mean, you can read about them at osprey.com. So every person on the ambassador team has a story, has a mission, has a purpose, and we have only maybe met each other on calls before, maybe in person, but I'm always so fascinated to learn more about my fellow ambassadors in this space, and so that's why I invited James to join me today and share his story. James is a freelance journalist, educator, and National Geographic explorer who tells stories about outdoor recreation and environmental conservation. He's worked in the outdoor recreation industry since 1989 as a guide, outfitter, sales rep, writer, and photographer. He is the author of The Adventure Gap, Changing the Face of the Outdoors, and the co-writer, co-producer of the documentary film An American Ascent. Both chronicled the first African-American expedition to climb North America's highest peak, Denali. So with that small little intro there, James, thank you so much for being here and welcome. Welcome to the show.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we are faces on a page. We're names in an email, you know, but there's a reason that we're all on Osprey's team, and I'm so curious, you know, what is it about a person that has made Osprey say, that one, we want them, you know, because it's a big deal. And so, just what I've seen about you so far is super fascinating and intriguing. And I think that your bio alone is just, I can feel the stories coming off of it. So why don't we start with just giving you an opportunity to introduce yourself in your own words and tell us who you are and where you come from.
Sure. Well, I can start by saying, number one, I'm a freelance journalist based in Madison, Wisconsin. I am talking to you today from the ancestral homeland of the Ho-Chunk people in a place that they've called since time immemorial Dajop, which is the place by the water. And I grew up originally in Los Angeles, California, and I spent much of my formative years in the Boy Scouts and having experiences in outdoor recreation, despite the fact that I lived in a very densely populated urban area, but still had ready access to the outdoors. So Griffith Park and the Baldwin Hill Scenic Overlook were places that I spent a great deal of time. And from literally my backyard, you could see the San Bernardino Mountains snow-capped to the east, in the ability to go and spend time in areas like Mammoth. And that ultimately led to an interest in being able to visit places like Yosemite and, ultimately the Grand Canyon and Yellowstone and a variety of other places in the outdoors. And I think very early on in life, I decided that I wanted to be able to, lead what can best be described as an adventurous lifestyle. And I had the rare occasion when I graduated from high school. That was in 1984, and that was not long after the film Raiders of the Lost Ark came out. And that was when I discovered that you could actually go to school and get a degree in a field like anthropology and perhaps be able to travel the world and go to exotic places and maybe fight a few Nazis along the way.
Yeah. And wow. Indiana Jones for the wind. For
absolutely.
The wind.
Yeah. And I was really excited about the prospects of being able to go to school and get a degree. So I graduated from high school, left Los Angeles, moved to Northern California, where I got a degree in anthropology from the University of California at Berkeley. And I spent a field semester as a field biologist in Panama. There's a research preserve operated by the Smithsonian Institute called Barro Colorado. And it was an island in the middle of the Panama Canal. And I spent 3 months, you know, I'm pretty sure I turned 21 on that trip. So this is very formative time in my life. I'm in the very last year of college and I'm thinking about what I'm going to do as a career. And I discovered that I really love spending time in foreign countries. I really enjoyed spending time in nature, but I also discovered that I really wasn't a big fan of the academic process in terms of being able to devote your entire academic career to the study of a single species or even a single category of species. And so I was kind of at a loss as to what I was going to do, but I took that same interest in outdoor creation and applied it, as many people who probably are fans of your program, to being able to get a career in outdoor recreation. So I got a job right out of college working for REI. And I worked at the Berkeley store on San Pablo Avenue. And what's interesting is that back then there was only 12 REI stores. This is store number 3. You know, and wow. So the outdoor industry at this time is actually very small. And so this is the year 1989. And I worked there for 3 years. I ran the rental desk, you know, so I was in charge of maintaining and distributing backpacks, tents, sleeping bags, hiking boots, trekking poles, ice axes, snowshoes. And in between, you know, I would spend time in the Sierras going skiing and climbing in the areas around Yosemite and getting some skills and expertise in mountaineering and climbing. And I'm really enjoying this time that I thought was just going to be a break between my undergrad degree to perhaps a career in anthropology as a professor of anthropology. And when I let my parents know that I was going to be what I described then and still do in many ways, an outdoor professional, they didn't know what to make of that, you know, simply because, you know, in the early 90s, you know, that wasn't a desk at career day. You know, it's not something
sure.
that you yeah. spend 4 years of your life in college to do to get a career in. But I was looking around me and there's a lot of people that were making a career doing this. You know, in fact, Galen Rowell, the photographer who did a lot of the amazing photographs of Yosemite, used to come into REI on a regular basis just as a customer, you know, and we got to become acquainted. And at the time, he was actually mentoring a young aspiring photographer by the name of Jimmy Chin. And I'm developing these early conversations about, you know, what a career in the outdoor industry might look like. And I volunteered to work one of the very first rock climbing competitions in Salt Lake City, Utah, actually Park City, Utah. It was the World Cup competition. And at that event, you know, I got a chance to meet some of the, you know, at the time, you know, there were many of them were close to my age, but, you know, there are people that, you know, went on to have amazing careers, like Alex Lowe, you know, was one of the event organizers. And there were climbers like Hans Florin, who was just a competitor at the time, and Will Gadd, who has gone on to be an amazing mountaineer in Canada, and, you know, people that are still really good friends today, like Bobby Bensman, who is a amazing professional in the outdoor industry as a sales rep, but also an aspiring rock climber, and Allison Osius, who has since been an editor of mine at Rock and Ice magazine. And so these are all people I'm literally meeting over the course of a single weekend. And much of that was kind of the start of, you know, my interest in figuring out what that can ultimately look like. And also during this event, I met a wonderful group of people, one woman in particular by the name of Ann Kerchak. She at the time was working at the North Face, and for some reason she seemed to want to help me foster my career, and she would invite me to come to her office at the North Face, because oddly enough, it was just around the corner from REI in Berkeley. This is back when it was still a privately held company. It wasn't a Fortune 500 behemoth that it is today, but, you know, we'd go and we'd have sushi in this little restaurant around the corner from both of our places of work, and a position opened up to become a customer service lead at the North Face customer service office, and I took that job and literally started, you know, doing everything that I was doing for REI, but I was doing things like, you know, managing sleeping bag returns and writing to customers about why their Gore-Tex wasn't working. And I was really getting a lot of really great experience handling equipment until finally, and this was at a really weird time in the industry, because at the time, the North Face was in the middle of trying to avoid Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And people were getting laid off and fired left and right, and they're making a lot of internal changes. And the sales manager for the whole company finds me in my little cubicle in the basement of the North Face office and asks me to come with him to the parking lot. And I'm literally thinking that he's just walking me out the door so I can get fired.
And leave faster.
Yeah, exactly. Reality was, he said, you know, James, we've taken a look at your resume. It's pretty impressive. Have you ever considered a career in sales? You know, and I'm 25 years old at the time and really had no idea what that was. And he's talking to me about the possibility of becoming a sales representative in one of two Midwestern territories. And I didn't understand a word he was saying, you know, but the reality was I was thinking, well, this sounds really good. For God's sake, don't say no.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so I said, yes. The next thing I know, I've been given propriety over a 6-state territory in the Midwest, literally all by myself, managing all North Face sales and marketing for an entire territory. And that was back in the days when the entire North Face line fit in the back of a Ford Explorer. You know, and so I got myself an Australian Shepherd puppy, and he and I traveled the Midwest territory for the next 5 years, selling tents and sleeping bags for the North Face, you know, doing clinics and, you know, and really just having a fabulous time doing it. And over the next decade, so I was an independent sales representative for almost 15 years. And so much of that began my career in sales. But one of the things that was remarkably striking to me that became more and more profound the longer I did it was that throughout my entire experience, there didn't seem to be any obstacles to my ability to be successful. I had a lot of mentors, a lot of really great opportunities. But I looked around and there weren't very many people of color that were part of my professional experience. And also in the private sector, there weren't very many people who were doing the work of outdoor recreation. And I knew that it's not because they weren't there. I just weren't seeing them. And they also didn't seem to be getting the same level of support and encouragement that I was. And it finally came to a head on September 11th, 2001, when the Twin Towers fell and we had a national crisis. And here I am, kind of at the height of my professional career, making more money than I ever thought that I could ever make in my entire life. But by that time, I was married, I had a house, you know, we were probably working on our fourth dog at this point. And I didn't have any way to become involved in the major events of the world other than to sell merchandise. And I also wasn't making any progress in terms of diversifying the outdoor recreation industry. And so I decided then that what I wanted to do was to try to fix this disparity between who spends time in nature and who doesn't. And at that point, I decided that I was going to close my marketing firm. And by that point, I was representing a bunch of different companies. So back then, I was working for Trango. I was working for Metolius. I had worked for Montrail, but before it was sold to Columbia Sportswear. I was working for Sierra Designs. And I literally shut all of those operations down. Told my wife that I was going to take a 80% pay cut and I was going to work at becoming a professional journalist. And I did that for initially just working for daily newspapers here in Wisconsin with a focus on business, but with still a continued interest in outdoor recreation. And much of that just led to me wanting to find more and more stories about people of color and our relationship with the outdoors. And that ultimately led, and I'm leaving a lot out just to, for the
sure. Purpose. This is a lifetime worth. Yeah, sure.
I was given an opportunity to visit Knowles in Wyoming. So the National Outdoor Leadership School, and the industry had just been starting to talk about the idea of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we're literally sitting in the Lander Bar in Lander, Wyoming. And I can't remember if it was me or the newly appointed director of diversity and inclusion, a woman by the name of Aparna Rajagopal Durban, who wanted to do something profound. And one of us came up with the idea that it would be cool to lead an all-African-American ascent of Denali. And that ultimately led to a big conversation about, you know, how can we remove the barriers of access to people who are underrepresented in the outdoor industry? And what can we do to make it so that we can have a generation of young people who recognize themselves as active members of this community that can become directly engaged and involved in these activities? And what can we do to really make a big splash out of that? And at the time, there had been plenty of people of color who had ascended Denali, but there'd never been a complete team. There'd never been a group of people not necessarily exclusive, but a majority team of climbers that would make the ascent to the highest peak in North America. And we put that program together. But what was really profound to me about this whole process, though, was because I'd never heard of anybody who had done it historically. So I literally put out a missive asking, okay, so who was the first African-American to summit Denali? And we posted that question onto outdoor industry listservs, you know, so like many organizations back, this is, you know, in the mid-2000s, so it's like 2010, 2011. And the first response and the next three responses were, who cares? You know, and there was this profound beginnings of the realization that there's going to be some pushback on this conversation, you know, because, you know, part of the issue is that technically it doesn't matter. Okay, but there had been historical disparities that have prevented people of color from becoming engaged and involved in these activities. But at some point, that barrier had been broken by someone. And I was very curious to know who that someone was. And no one could tell me until finally someone pointed out a very obscure climber by the name of Charles Madison Crenshaw, who in 1964 had become the first Black American to summit Denali. And I mean, hey, that's great. Now I know. But then, you know, it kind of peels back this entire layer of his story as a person. So Charlie Crenshaw was a member of the Tuskegee Airmen. You know, so these are Black fighter pilots in World War II who helped to liberate Europe after the Battle of Normandy and D-Day. You know, they flew bomber escort missions over the Atlantic into Germany to help, you know, liberate Europe. You know, he came back to the United States, got a degree in mechanical engineering at the University of Chicago. And this is in the 1950s now, after the Second World War. And then he went on to become a engineer at a little company called Boeing and relocated to the Pacific Northwest and was part of the Apollo missions to put a man on the moon. You know, and while he's doing all this, you know, he's also an avid climber. And so he's taking his love and interest in outdoor recreation to become, you know, a member of the Seattle Mountaineers. He was an officer in the American Alpine Club. You know, he was an avid rescuer of climbers on Mount Rainier. You know, he's doing all these amazing things. And then what's most remarkable is, you know, as I'm doing research, I discovered that there's a profile on him in Ebony Magazine in the September issue of 1963, the same issue that has a profile on the 1963 March on Washington a month earlier.
Okay.
And so, ironically, Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech concludes with a liturgy of mountains that should be climbed as an expression of American freedom. You know, and so he says, from every mountainside, let freedom ring. Let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California, from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. And he's laying all this out. So he's literally making the case for outdoor recreation being a vehicle through which civil rights can be achieved. A year later, Crenshaw is the first African-American to make the ascent of Denali. And 7 days before the Civil Rights Act is signed into law. And he literally personifies the ascension of mountains and the achievement of civil liberties through outdoor recreation. This is an amazing story that closed the minute it opened. I spent my entire life living in California, spent my entire life, you know, in outdoor recreation. And here I am in my mid-40s hearing this story for the very first time. You know, we did not do a very good job of telling his story, telling his legacy, talking about who he was as a person. And then when you take a look at all the other things that we learn about what we think we know about outdoor recreation, we realize that there are many stories that we haven't been told. You know, so for example, African-American buffalo soldiers were responsible for the protection and preservation of Sequoia and Yosemite National Parks. The same units of cavalry and enlisted men protected Yellowstone. You know, you have all these remarkable stories that we can ground people of color in our relationship with the outdoors if we successfully tell them effectively. And so now working as a National Geographic Explorer, that's my specialty. I tell the stories of the historic incidents in national parks primarily, as well as national monuments and battlefields, of the stories of African Americans and people of color of all stripes with regard to our relationship with the natural world as is interpreted by the National Park Service. And so now working in partnership with National Geographic, we're telling a new series of stories that are part of a podcast series that I create called Unhidden. And it's a series called The Unhidden Minute. And every Tuesday at 8:05 a.m., we post a story that lasts 1 minute that tells anybody who's willing to listen a story about a person of color in a national park who's done something remarkable. And it's also national monuments. In fact, today's episode was about the Japanese soldiers who fought in World War II, whose parents were interned in internment camps in Manzanar in California during the Second World War because of the executive order restricting people of Japanese descent to concentration camps on American soil. You know, and so it's really important that we tell an infinitely more comprehensive story about who we are, how we got here, and what we can collectively do to tell infinitely more comprehensive stories. You only asked me one question. I gave you a very lengthy answer. But as you can imagine, as a writer, I talk about these kinds of things on a regular basis. And it's kind of, you know, what I do now. And it's a pretty clean line for me. It's basically the story of my life. And, you know, I'm just really grateful for the opportunity to share these conversations with people like you and many of the people who read my magazine articles and my books and my stories on my website and other points of contact and interest. So,
okay, there's one piece that I want to break down about the story that you told, and that was, it's going back almost all the way to the beginning, but I really, really love it because as you were just saying, and then this happened, you know, and then I did this and then I did this, but what I love that you came from a city where you could see the mountains and you said, I want more of that. Okay. You got a job at REI in between college or undergrad and postgrad, let's say maybe. And that totally changed your story. And what I love about the getting a job at REI is that you were working in a retail shop around the things that you wanted to be around. And that it's such a simple step that I don't want to overlook because we all have interests, right? We have passions. We have things that draw us. All of these things are the lights and the beacons on the path that are meant for us, right? This is the path that's going to get James to James. This is the path that's going to get Jackie to Jackie. And as long as I keep listening to those beacons and finding these things that feel like me, I'm drawn to this, I'm drawn to that, you end up at REI and it opens up this whole story for you. Essentially, we just heard it 20 minutes worth, you know, beautiful thing. And it was such a simple thing. And I want to stop and acknowledge that you exposed yourself to just an interest, you know, the next stepping stone on the path you couldn't exactly see yet. And it was not hard because it was a job at REI, right?
Right. Well, let me break that down a little bit for you more because it was a deliberate decision.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure it was.
And I'll tell you how deliberate and exactly how specific it was because it was an answer to a question. The question was, what do I want to do with my life? And then the answer was getting a job that would allow me to do the things that I most want to do. And I really felt like I had two choices. I can either get a job. Like I literally was, you know, also interviewing with public relations firms and sales and marketing organizations that would give me the finances to be able to do almost anything that I wanted to exclusively on a monetary basis, but not necessarily the free time, at least not free time that I could control very readily. REI allowed me to have exposure to the things that I was most interested in, to be around it all day, all the time, literally 5 days a week and the weekends, because that's how I was spending my downtime. And I wasn't making a ton of money. I mean, back then, you know, I was making minimum wage, but I also wasn't spending full price on a new backpack.
Sure. Yeah. Your gear discounts.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You know, and I was, you know, getting, you know, discounted lift tickets. You know, I was being able to, you know, have access to some of the best climbing gear available. And, you know, I literally, you know, had these amazing cohort of friends. You know, I mean, literally, I mean, I'm not kidding you. I can't tell you how many times, and this is back in the late 80s, when it was a regular thing for somebody to climb the cables on the Golden Gate Bridge. Yeah. It's literally one of those things where, you know, you have exposure to these things. I mean, like, you know, being able to spend your lunch break at Indian Rock in Berkeley, that's where Alex Honnold did all of his early climbing. You know, I mean, to literally being able to have these moments where, you know, you are not pinned down with making a living because you're too busy having a life.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that typically what happens to me personally and professionally is that there's going to be something that will force a pivot of some kind, you know, and sometimes it's a change of circumstances, you know, whether it's due to an injury or an illness or a death in the family or just a change of cultural, social circumstances. But, you know, one of the things that was kind of a pivot for me was, you know, this was literally at the beginning of the dot-com boom. When suddenly real estate in California was getting really expensive. I mean, we all know how expensive it is now. It used to be, I mean, I had a rent-controlled apartment in Berkeley that I was spending $230 a month on with a roommate. You know, and but I can see it ratcheting up, and then when the opportunity to move to the Midwest came up, you know, and I was, you know, looking around to see where I was going to live and realized that I could buy two houses for the cost of the down payment on what they were looking for, a house in California. I'm like going, sign me up, you know, and that was, again, another one of those vehicles. You know, my whole family still lives in California. Before I got married, Madison was just where I kept my stuff, you know, and I was still bouncing around, you know, still working as a sales rep, traveling a very large territory, but then, you know, doing sales meetings out in California or, you know, in the Southeast or in Colorado. And then we'd go on, you know, retreats to, you know, to climb or ski in Europe or whatever. And all of this was just, and again, I couldn't have planned this. But I think more than anything else, what I did was I created an opportunity that allowed me to be open to the possibility of things, you know, and that's kind of the way my entire life has been structured. And in that way, I've been really, really, really lucky, you know, to quite literally be in a position where someone, and I'm kidding you, this happens literally to me all the time and has for years. Someone said, hey, we've got an extra seat on a boat. We're paddling the Grand Canyon. Can you take 2 weeks off next month and come with us? Who has the ability to do that?
You do. Because you've set yourself up. Yeah.
You know, by design, you know, and then ultimately that leads to, you know, being able as a writer. And this is where it really comes together, where I can take that experience and turn it into a chapter in a book or a magazine article or a story of some kind, a podcast episode, or more than anything else, just a life experience that can allow you to be competent to talk about other things, you know, that leads you open to whatever is happening next. You know, so that from that trip to the Grand Canyon, I was qualified then to do another trip on the Grand Canyon 2 years later on another invitation. You know, prior to that first trip, you know, it took us 10 years to get a permit, you know, just to be able to do it the first time. By the time the second time rolled around, I had already had 2 weeks of paddling experience on the Colorado River, so I could jump into another experience doing it 2 years later. You know, and in between, you know, we're doing, you know, the expedition to Denali in 2022. I was invited to help put together an all African American ascent of Everest, which is a film that's coming out. Apparently, I didn't even know what the title is, but it's going to premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival in June, so in just in a couple of days.
Yeah, that will have happened maybe by the time this episode even comes out. So
sure, yeah. So hopefully, I guess. But again, I mean, being able to open yourself up to the prospects, and the last thing that I'll say too is that one of the things that has really helped to inform the nature of what I do is my not only willingness, but expressed desire to make sure that I'm making similar experiences available to other people.
Right.
You know, so when I put together an expedition to someplace, you know, I'm using all my outdoor industry contacts and ability to put together a program where I can invite people to come along. So for example, one of the last visits I had to Montana was to traverse a section of the Missouri River through the White Cliffs section of the Missouri River to retrace a portion of the Lewis and Clark expedition with the purpose of telling the story of the one Black participant of the Lewis and Clark expedition, an enslaved man by the name of York. And that film is now part of a series of national park sponsored programs called Big Medicine York Outdoors. But what was interesting about that story was that we put together a small team of primarily Black, well, let's call it exclusively Black environmental educators who had an interest in telling this story, and they came along with us. But all the people on this crew, you know, had all the gear that they needed. They had that had, you know, water bottles and headlamps and everything that they needed to be successful. And we were able to pay them a couple thousand dollars to be part of this program.
Great.
Literally just yesterday, I got back from doing a similar project on Isle Royale, which is the least visited national park in the system. Well, least visited in the lower 48 states. It's actually the third least visited national park in the system. But we got a crew of 14 people, seven participants, myself, and a small film crew to be able to create a documentary around our experiences there. And I can say that they all had Osprey backpacks.
Of course they did. Mine all do too.
Right. Well, you know, yeah. But Osprey provided them.
Right.
You
know, I'm sure. Yeah.
We got absolutely. Sponsorship from companies like Scarpa and Sawyer Products. You know, the North Face chipped in gear, you know, so that relationship that I've had with North Face that now goes back over 35 years is still technically intact.
We'll come right back to that. But first, let's thank the brands that support our show. Let's talk about a new bag from Osprey that's getting awards and lots of hype, the Scuffle. What in the world is a scuffle? Well, if you put square and duffel together, you get scuffle, which is exactly what this bag is, a square-shaped duffel. Now, just to be clear, when it's all zipped up, it's rectangular and easy to carry with its stowaway backpack straps. But the coolest feature about this bag is that you not only have the option of opening it via the U-zip panel access to the top, but you can also unzip all the way around the perimeter of the bag, opening it up like a clamshell, which creates a square. If you need help imagining this, go to osprey.com and check out the Scuffle. That's S-Q-U-F-F-E-L to see this magic that I'm talking about. I love the clamshell option because I am a very organized packer. And with everything in its proper packing cube, I can further organize by packing clothes on one side of the clamshell and gear and toiletries on the other. There are zip dividers to keep the contents of each side secure, and these dividers are roll away if you prefer not to use them. I love a good versatile bag, and that's exactly what the Scuffle is. It comes in both 44 and 70 liter sizes, so you can carry it on or check it if you want. The zippers all slide super smoothly, which is important to me. It has burly webbing grab handles on every side. Its Blue Sign approved nano-tough exterior is remarkably strong and highly water resistant. So, it's absolutely worthy of being thrown into the back of a pickup truck full of hockey gear for an away tournament. And when you get to said tournament and realize the rain leaked through the shell of the back of the truck, you'll be relieved that only your hockey gear is wet, not your clothes that were packed safely and securely inside your new Scuffle. I wish I could say I wasn't speaking from experience on that one, but that is exactly why the Scuffle gets full approval from me and two thumbs up. You can find the Scuffle and all the packing cubes that fit perfectly inside it at osprey.com. Are you interested in traveling to Patagonia or anywhere else in Chile or Argentina? Of course you are. I have good news, not so good news, and great news for you. The not so good news is that it's often logistically super challenging to plan trips to certain destinations in Chile and Argentina because of advanced permitting, limited capacity, vast distances between locations, border crossings, and a myriad of other bureaucratic issues. The good news is that my friends over at ecochile.travel and ecoargentina.travel can handle all of these logistics for you and help you plan the trip of your dreams. They are local, they know the systems, they speak the language, they also speak English, and building custom trips is what they do. I've traveled with EcoChile before. I actually went to Easter Island through them on my last trip to Chile, and I was mind blown at how well I was treated as a traveler. The amount of support and materials they provided me made me feel like I was in such good hands. And for me, being the one who usually does all the planning, oh my goodness, it feels so good to be taken care of, like to the last little detail, especially because I had not been to Easter Island before. I trusted their expertise and my experience was even better than I imagined. Whether you know exactly what you want to experience in a destination or you don't, EcoChile will work with your interests, travel style, budget, time frame, and take care of every piece of your itinerary that you want them to handle. Think nature, hiking, wildlife, boutique lodges, road trips, local culture, and real connection with the destination, all while having reliable logistics and support throughout your entire trip. That's what EcoChile provides. And the great news is that when you go to ecochile.travel or ecoargentina.travel to book with them, you can receive 5% off your trip. Just select Traveling Jackie in the inquiry form or mention me in your email, phone, or WhatsApp message. Go to ecochile.travel and start your dream trip planning today. Don't forget to tell them Traveling Jackie sent you. And thank you, wherever you are, for listening to the show and supporting these brands that help make it possible. We'll come right back to that, but first, let's thank the brands that support our show. Let's talk about a new bag from Osprey that's getting awards and lots of hype, the Scuffle. What in the world is a scuffle? Well, if you put square and duffel together, you get scuffle, which is exactly what this bag is, a square-shaped duffel. The coolest feature about this bag is that you not only have the option of opening it via the U-zip panel access to the top, but you can also unzip all the way around the perimeter of the bag, opening it up like a clamshell, which creates a square. I love the clamshell option because I am a very organized packer, and with everything in its proper packing cube, I can further organize by packing clothes on one side of the clamshell and gear and toiletries on the other. There are zip dividers to keep the contents of each side secure, and these dividers are roll-away if you prefer not to use them. It comes in both 44 and 70 liter sizes, so you can carry it on or check it if you want. The zippers all slide super smoothly, which is important to me. It has burly webbing grab handles on every side. Its Blue Sign approved nano-tough exterior is remarkably strong and highly water resistant. So it's absolutely worthy of being thrown into the back of a pickup truck full of hockey gear for an away tournament. And when you get to said tournament and realize the rain leaked through the shell of the back of the truck, you'll be relieved that only your hockey gear is wet, not your clothes that were packed safely and securely inside your new scuffle. That is exactly why the scuffle gets full of approval from me and two thumbs up. You can find the scuffle and all the packing cubes that fit perfectly inside it at osprey.com. And thank you, wherever you are, for listening to the show and supporting these brands that help make it possible.
Do you organize these trips yourself?
I do.
Okay, so this is one of the many things that you do, is you put together these adventures outdoors. Amazing. What's that?
Well, the purpose of it, you know, I mean, it's really interesting because, you know, not unlike the Denali expedition, you know, especially when we're talking about working with underrepresented segments of the population, the event in and of itself is an accomplishment. But then if you can tell a competent story about it as well, that event takes on a completely different life in photographs, in magazine articles, in conversation, and again, more than anything else, being able to have our participants go back into their communities and be able to share their experience with people around them. And so, you know, I wouldn't go so far to suggest that what we're doing is viral, but it has the sense of being able to engage and inspire more than just one person. You know, the images, the stories, the conversation that comes out of every one of these experiences has power and resonance. And When I put these trips together, I'm not doing it exclusively for the money, but there is money to be made doing it. You know, I can, you know, do these trips, you know, at cost. You know, and the great thing about living in the Midwest, I almost owe less on our house right now than I do on our car. You know, and I've been paying the same mortgage since 1998. So suffice it to say, you know, my cost of living is actually very low, so I can still afford to have a high quality of life that is impactful to other people without having to worry about making a ton of money in the process. You know, And again, getting back to your original question, all this is by design, with the flexibility of being able to allow yourself to take advantage of whatever opportunities present themselves. And next week, as I mentioned to you, I'm going to be in Montana on my way to Yellowstone to do I wouldn't call it a guided trip. I'm technically the National Geographic expert on the national park for a segment on ABC News 2020, profiling national parks all over the country for the 4th of July for the sesquicentennial celebration. So the plan is to be in the park with Deborah Roberts of 2020 to lead her through the very first national park and to visit Mammoth Hot Springs, to visit Grand Prismatic, Old Faithful, Grand Geyser, the amazing bison herd, and to be able to talk about the story of why our national parks are so important. But for my purposes, being able to tell this story from the perspective of a person of color who recognizes the importance of being able to tell the story of the Buffalo Soldier Bicycle Corps that rode bikes from Missoula to Mammoth Hot Springs and then to St. Louis in 1897. You know, to be able to talk about the remarkable work of George Melendez Wright, whose research on the buffalo made it possible for us to have national parks that protect and preserve endangered species. You know, had it not been from a Hispanic man who also graduated from Berkeley to create the system of biological research in order to maintain the integrity of endangered species, it's because of him that the bison didn't go extinct. You know, it's critically important that we tell these stories. I mean, talk about the fact that the first Black members of Congress during the Reconstruction era actually voted on the legislation that brought the Yellowstone Act into creation in 1872. You know, so there are these remarkable stories to tell in these beautiful places that are part of our national heritage that can be shared through storytelling, but most importantly, through visiting, to actually getting in a car, getting on a plane, doing what you can to get there. And you may not be able to get there in style, you know, and stay in the grand lodges and the big hotels, but I think that it's really important that everybody has an opportunity to figure out what they need to go to get to where they want to be.
And planning in advance is one of those things these days because they've gotten so popular, which really is a good thing. It's good that the exposure is happening. And
absolutely. Yeah. And I think that it's critically important that we kind of prioritize the importance of protecting our national parks, even the ones that we may never visit.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe especially the ones that we'll never visit. And I think if we can make the case that, you know, our national parks are actually part of an idea of democracy that is all about the preservation of natural resources, about the equitable access of those natural resources to all people. You don't have to go to Yellowstone or Yosemite in order to do that. Okay, you can do that wherever you live. Nature is all around us.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why I really think that it's important that we have a very similar ethos to outdoor recreation to wherever we happen to live, whether you live in a small college town like Madison, where I live, or whenever I go back home to Los Angeles. I think that it's really important that we recognize that nature is everywhere. And with some community engagement and thoughtful practices, we can maintain the integrity of our natural resources for generations to come.
I love this. I love how this has come full circle back to, you know, the what we were talking about at the beginning. I do have a couple follow-up questions for you and some observations, because I think the biggest question is, looking back, knowing how you felt on September 11th of 2001 and being able to see now, that was 25 years ago, where you've come and how you felt inside then, what sentiments come up for you when you look inside now? You know, you pivoted, you used that word, like your path changed that day. You made some big decisions. Seeing now, knowing how far you've come, even though you couldn't design that path in advance, that was something that happened as it happened, right? Because you've been following the beacons and the signs for the path that looks like James. How do you feel now? Have you accomplished what you set out to do?
You know, it's really interesting because there are times, especially when I am in my own head and not worrying about what other people are up to, I take a look around and I say, wow, I've actually done a lot of what I'd hoped to achieve. You know, the ability to have a lifestyle and a home and a family and a community that is supportive of me. But at the same time, I've been to Washington, D.C. twice already this year to lobby Congress on behalf of the environment. You know, that is what I wish I could have done in 2001.
But you're doing it now.
Exactly.
That's what you wanted to do. And here you are. That's my point.
Yeah. And that is exactly why I made that pivot, so that I can find myself in the position that I'm in now. You know, but at the same time, I mean, to be able to do that without having been made to feel like I had to sacrifice everything, you know, and the good news is, at least for me back then, you know, it was a relatively low bar, you know, because this may sound horrible, but my only cost of failure would be to actually get a real job.
A real job. Overrated. You know,
yeah. I mean, I've literally been self-employed for my entire career. After I left the North Face, I've never worked for anybody sense directly. No, I definitely had a time when I was working at the on the Wisconsin State Journal as a daily newspaper reporter. You know, and that was literally, I was writing the stories that I wanted to write. I was taking assignments, but I was also pitching a lot of things. I was designing my understanding of what it was like to be a professional journalist. I never felt like I was employed by the paper. I felt like I was writing the paper, bought my stories from me. And that's, and that's kind of how, you know, journalism works.
Right.
You know, and that's how it works now. So when I pitch to outside rock and ice, alpinist, climbing, backpacker, whatever, it's the exact same thing that I was doing then that I'm doing now. You know, and so being able to make that pivot, I definitely think created a lot of autonomy for me. But at the same time, I think at the very crux of all this is also having a very supportive, understanding and encouraging spouse. You know, being able to, you know, my wife Shemaine worked as a professional journalist herself. She's an award winning public radio reporter for NPR for the the first 25 years of our marriage. She recently took early retirement so that she can indulge her interest in running and cycling all over again. You know, and I'm
good
grateful that, you know, we've been able to create an environment now where, you know, she doesn't have to make as much money, so she doesn't have to work as hard, so she can devote that energy into something that makes her happy. And I'm just really grateful for the opportunity to be able to do that. And again, a lot of that I owe to the people who believe in the work that I do and that they're prepared to support it financially. You know, so when we look at, you know, getting grants from, like, with this wonderful grant during the pandemic from Patagonia. And it's so funny, the request for proposals came out at the exact same time, one from Patagonia, the other one from National Geographic. Both had the same question. Tell us a story about people engaged in the outdoors during the pandemic. Patagonia actually had one stipulation, take us someplace that doesn't require you to fly.
Okay. Yeah.
And so for me, the Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan on Lake Superior is a place for exquisite ice climbing. It's a 6.5 hour drive from Madison. And so that was going to be my pitch. But then I said, well, how about if I took a bunch of people who wouldn't be able to get there otherwise? And so it just so happened that the Michigan Ice Festival had to be canceled that year because of the pandemic. You know, we had social distancing. We couldn't have these group undertakings. And so I started creating what I started calling escape pods. and an escape pod was literally a group of people that would be prepared to get COVID tested, to socially isolate so that we can and get a negative test right before we went into the field. And then we could, you know, share housing, share meals, share transportation, et cetera. And so the proprietors of Downwind Sports that put on this event every year had all these resources that they couldn't dump into the festival. So they gave them to me.
Whoa, that's amazing.
And we got a group of people from Detroit and Grand Rapids, Michigan on a bus and took them up to the Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore, and these, you know, people from very urban areas learn how to ice climb, you know, and, you know, we prepared meals and we just had a wonderful time, and it became a feature story for National Geographic magazine, you know, and so, and then that, you know, led to, you know, other stories that, you know, had very similar interests and outcomes. And that's what the same people from the same group, came with us to our El Royale project that we just concluded last, you know, literally, I just drove down from the island yesterday, you know, and so, you know, and the work continues. But again, the great thing about it is that, you know, as we progress telling more interesting stories, there's, you know, another funding source, you know, there's another sponsor opportunity, there's another conversation to be had. And the great thing about it is that, you know, there's 62 terrestrial national parks, you know, so we could technically do projects like this, you know, for another decade or two, at least until my knees give out. So Yeah, I think we're in a good place to be able to move this conversation forward. And I think a big part of it is quite literally just putting yourself in a position where you are flexible and available to make turns when circumstances require it. But most importantly, if you can make those experiences available to people who aren't you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I honestly think that by providing other people with the things that you most want for yourself, chances are there's going to be a little bit left over for you that you can then turn around, enjoy yourself, and then share with somebody else.
Absolutely. This is, I see you, I hear you. This is the reason that I built Jump Adventures. I mean, I took podcast listeners on adventures for the last 10 years. So are you a Sagittarius?
Virgo.
Okay. I was going to say, I feel like there's just a lot of similar, like I love how you've let yourself figure out your story. I love that the passion and the efforts, everything that you've put into your story are actually the bits that you then share, because it's so authentic. It's so real. It's so personal. It's all you, all these stories that you're writing and, you know, cause you're going to do this activity and then you're, you know, writing about it, sharing about it, you're exposing other people to the thing that lit you up, that you got exposed to by, you know, way back in the day when you said, mountains, me, you know, and here you are doing this thing. This might also be a big question. What are you the most proud of? That's kind of a hard question, but maybe what are you the most proud of that you've accomplished or that you want eyes on, you know, like
sure.
An external project.
Okay. I mean, and it's really interesting because I can't believe that we've been talking for over 45 minutes and I haven't mentioned my platform once. You know, so
I'm trying to get you there.
Yeah. So yeah. Shortly after I, you know, made the decision to go 100% freelance, this was around the time of the Great Recession in 2008. You know, I had lost the podcasting gig that I'd been doing for the last 2 years. And I decided that I was going to make a platform of my own. And it was in 2009 that I created the Joy Trip Project, which is originally it was just a podcast. And this is in 2009. And back then it was, I mean, we didn't have anywhere near the technology that we have right now.
Yeah.
But truthfully at the time, it was really just a demo tape to get ready for a career working for public radio, which is really what I was interested in. I mean, my entire ethos has been built around public broadcasting. But every time I applied for a real job working for public radio, I honestly feel like they felt I was overqualified or that I was doing other really cool and exciting things that I would just get bored with working in their studios. So I needed to learn broadcasting almost all by myself, you know, and it really wasn't until, you know, I started, you know, getting a little bit better at it by putting stuff out there and freelancing and, you know, being able to, you know, get, you know, really cool guests in that first season, like Ken Burns and Terry Tippis Williams. And, gosh, we had, Pico Iyer and, you know, like all of these amazing people that just showed up to, much like you're doing now,
yeah,
sit and tell me their stories. And, you know, then that led to, you know, the ability to do the Denali expedition and the Everest expedition and everything else since, you know, so the Joy Trip Project is a platform right now. You know, I can't believe we're in our 18th season.
Yeah, you know, congratulations.
And, yeah, being able to maintain the integrity of this platform for so long and with the patience of the audience, because frankly, it's only just recently that I've been able to develop the bandwidth and the infrastructure to do regular episodes currently on a weekly basis, soon going once a week for a minute, but then longer episodes once a month with a great sponsor through YMCA of the Rockies to be able to tell stories about, again, other people. So we're basically doing audio versions of the Joy Trip Reading Project, which is a conversation of authors of books, primarily books that focus on the roles of people of color in the outdoors. And so our first guest is going to be Dudley Edmondson, the author of the book, People the Planet Need Now. And We've got a huge lineup of some amazing writers who are telling fantastic stories about diversity and inclusion and environmental protection and all the things that are exciting for me, that with this platform, we can elevate their stories and hopefully inspire others. So that's the thing that I'm really hanging my hat on right now. And I'm really looking forward to figuring out what the next things are.
Yeah.
and to be able to move all this forward. And I think really, too, my relationship with National Geographic has been, you know, really profound and exciting in that, you know, they have, you know, given me platform opportunities. The Museum of Discovery is actually opening in 2 weeks, and I've been invited to come to the opening. And I'm told, well, they ask me for artifacts of my career. And so they're literally talking about creating a display with the other explorers who are contributors to the magazine and people who've contributed to the society. So I gave them the PFD that I wore on the Grand Canyon, along with a wrap night and a retired version of my hat, some photographs. So, you know, I'm really grateful for the opportunity to be able to actually have a physical presence, you know, in a museum that is all about history and storytelling.
That's a pretty big deal. That's really cool. Oh my goodness. Oh, this is so neat. Like, your story is just, I have so many more questions I wish that we had time for. But I suppose I can just tune in and pay attention to what you're doing and follow along and be so grateful for this conversation, because it's so neat. I mean, I love, just on more of kind of a general note, I love sharing a story that's just so authentic, you know, and organic, and just came from interest and passion and paying attention and awareness and saying, I can do that. So why don't I, you know, and exposure. And I mean, I feel like if we were to break down this story into actionable steps, your first one was absolutely prioritizing. You knew when you took that job at REI, you were prioritizing your life quality over monetary anything, right? You shared that with us. I think step two would have been exposure. You're saying yes to things that got you out there, that made you rub elbows with these people who then said, saw something in you. I mean, it's funny because when you say, for some reason, and this woman that you mentioned at the beginning, you know, took an interest in me and blah, blah, I mean, it's because there's that magic, there's that thing that's happening with you that, you know, we're all meant to be in community together and to build these things, these stories. And so there's a reason you couldn't see the path from the very beginning, but the fact that you continued to show up for that and then get to where you are and then actually create, I think that was probably the third step is, I'm just like spitballing these things, but you know, you actually created the thing that you kind of were building this entire time, but maybe didn't realize exactly what it would look like at the beginning, you know, and now you're taking that to the next step. And I love that you don't know what's next. We don't know what's next, but I have a feeling that you're going to continue, you know, following those signs and those beacons and those feelings of where James is meant to be and just keep creating good things. And I think that's so cool. Like, I'm very inspired. Yeah. Oh,
well, thank you for listening. I really appreciate taking the time, and I'm really grateful for your curiosity, because, you know, frankly, I think it's in community and in conversation that we ultimately grow, you know, and collectively figure out and discover what's next.
Yeah,
you know, and
totally is.
And I guess it just really depends. I mean, you know, and oddly enough, you know, despite the changes in technology, despite the changes in how we deliver these systems, what we're doing right now is not at all different than, I mean, literally when I started my career in broadcasting, you know, we were still using cassette tapes. You know,
that's,
you know,
so cool.
There was no digital. We literally had to pot in real time over to you know, recording platforms. And so, you know, things have changed a lot, but the inner communication between people hasn't changed at all. You know, it's cold calling a source, asking a question. And I think, you know, perhaps more than anything else, it's your ability, and I think you're very good at it, to be able to, you know, identify a person's interests, so that you can keep them engaged. I heard it said many times that interesting people are interested. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that if you're interested in what people are doing, you know, you can literally make them think that you're an even better person than you are because you let them tell you all about them. You know, and so it's really funny. So my father suffered a stroke many years ago, and he lost his ability to speak. But he's still a very personal and engaging person. And I was working as a producer of a live public radio variety show, you know, and I would book all the acts and help, you know, the hosts get questions and so forth. And my parents just happened to be in town for the night of my last show. My parents, like, they visited me in Wisconsin maybe twice, and this was the second time. And so we have, you know, kind of a, and so I came, introduced my parents to the host of the show. He goes, "Oh, well, I hope you have a great time, you know, enjoy yourselves in the audience." Show went on. The host talked to my mom and my dad's there again. He's not saying anything because he doesn't have the ability to speak. And then, my wife takes them off to the side where we have our debrief from the show. Again, my last show, the host comes to me and says, "Well, you know, I'm really glad your parents enjoyed your show. Your father told me how much he enjoyed it." And I said, "Did he?" And he goes, "Yeah, he honestly in his head was explaining the conversation that he had with my dad that he could not possibly have had."
Right.
Because my dad literally cannot talk. My father and I have not had a conversation in 30 years. Okay? But he is so well engaged and so in tuned with people and expresses a certain amount of emotion and energy through his very presence that make people think that he's speaking volumes to them, even though he's not uttering a word. You know, and I think that in many ways, that's something that I've aspired to learn how to do by expressing an interest in other people and the things that they do. I'm not doing it as well as I do it now because I know that you're interested in talking to me and I want to be able to help you to create content for your program. But the long and short of it is that I think that we all need to be very interested in other people's interesting lives.
Yes. Yeah. Because that's the relatable piece too. And that's where we learn. I mean, everybody has a story. Everybody has a story.
Absolutely. You know?
Yeah. Okay. As we wrap up, two last things. One, what, after this whole conversation, what is it that you want people to know?
I want people to know that they have the capacity to make themselves happy.
That's great. I love that.
And I think that in many ways, it is their pursuit of whatever it is that brings them joy. And I don't think enough people realize how much they have control over their own way of life. I've always believed that we write our own stories. And if you don't like the way things are working out, write yourself a new ending.
Yep. Pivot. Change it. Yep. Find a new path. Follow those beacons and those signs. Yep. Okay. And then one last thing is, where can people find and follow you should they want to pay attention to what you're doing? Where can they find your podcast and everything?
My primary platform is joytripproject.com. And if you hit Joy Trip Project or The Joy Trip Project on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, those are all the places where you will find much of my work. And we try to do a good job of directing people to the work that I do that's not on the platform. So for example, because of search engine optimization, it's not a good idea for me to republish something that's already published on the website for Osprey, for example, you know, or for National Geographic or Outside Magazine or Rock and Ice or anybody else that I've ever published with. So if you're interested in finding out what some of my bylines are, you go to my website first, and there'll probably be links that will redirect someone to those other platforms.
Okay. I'm going to make sure that link to your website is in the show notes. And yes, I can't thank you enough. This has been really great. I really hope Montana treats you well this next week when you're here.
And yeah, as long as the weather holds up, I'm looking forward to it. I'm excited that they're going to include an afternoon of fishing.
So world class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm dying to. I fished the Snake River out of Jackson and unsuccessfully. And I think it's only because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. This time they hired a guide, so at the very least I'll get some basic beta to be able to hopefully get something on the line. So I'm excited.
Good. I'm excited for you. I think we've just had a lot of rain, and I don't think we're going to get that this weekend for you coming up. So, yeah, but be safe out there. And I am very much looking forward to just hearing more from you and continuing to see what you're doing. And good luck with everything. And yeah, it was so great to meet you online, at least. And yes, well, thank you again.
The pleasure's mine. I'm sure that our paths will cross in the real world one day.
I hope so. Yeah, I think they will. All right. Thanks, James.
Enjoy the rest of your day. Bye-bye.